From economic uncertainty to demographic change, voters in 2016 are an angry lot. Just ahead, we've got an in-depth look at the reasons why. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9. Catch the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And now watch the show streaming on demand at tvjax.com. Just ahead, an all-star panel as we talk about the American voters' angry mood in 2016. Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Also this morning, PBS host Joe Lamp, plus a special conversation with rock legend Graham Nash, a preview of his concert tomorrow night in Ponte Vedra. All of that and more ahead this morning, but first this hour, we are joining with NPR this week in a political conversation, taking a close look at the state of mind of the American voter. From growing economic uncertainty to fears of terrorism, to worries about our very identity as a nation, the mood of the voters this year is anxious, frightened, and angry. In a moment, we'll take your calls and get your thoughts about the reasons why as we welcome an all-star panel to Studio 5. But first, NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson has a look at why the voters are so full of discontent.
You can't talk to voters this year without hearing some pretty powerful emotions, and all the candidates are trying to show they get it. For Republicans like Marco Rubio, it's President Obama's fault.
And a president that on 10 occasions around the world has apologized for America. Apologized. And this is why people are so frustrated. This is why they're so angry. That's why this election's played out so differently.
On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders' angry tirades have found a receptive audience.
This campaign is sending a message to the billionaire class. Yes, we have the guts to take you on.
Hillary Clinton has talked herself hoarse, explaining that she takes seriously the fears and insecurities of ordinary voters.
They're worried that they're going to be left behind while the people on the top, the guys who always get ahead, keep taking, leaving very little for anybody else. There's a lot of worry.
And no one has identified with or stoked voters' anger better than Donald Trump.
I will gladly accept the mantle of anger. Our military is a disaster. Our health care is a horror show. Obamacare, we're going to repeal it and replace it. We have no borders. Our vets are being treated horribly. Illegal immigration is beyond belief.
There are lots of good reasons voters are so ticked off this year. Number one, says former White House aide Bill Galston, is the absence of the kind of broadly shared economic growth that makes the American dream possible.
When you consider the fact that household incomes are still thousands of dollars below where they were at the end of the Clinton administration, people have gone a long time without making a lot of progress, and they know it. They're feeling it, and they're not very happy about it.
So what are the other factors driving all that voter discontent? Well, fear of terrorism. Also, worries about demographic changes and immigration and political gridlock, frustration that nothing ever seems to get done in Washington. We want to know what you think about all this. Why do you think the voters are angry? What are you angry about? Give us a call at 549-2937. And right now, with their thoughts on voter anxiety in 2016, we welcome UNF President and former Jacksonville Mayor John Delaney. Good morning.
Morning.
Also with us, Florida Times Union columnist Tanya Weathersby.
Good morning.
Matt Corrigan of UNF's Political Science Department and the author of the Jeb Bush bio, Conservative Hurricane. Good to see you.
Hi, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, A.G. Gankarski, writer with Florida Politics.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have all four of you on this show. And here's our question to callers. What are you angry about, or are you angry this election year? What's driving voter discontent in your mind? Give us a call with your thoughts at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us. Lots of comments already on our Facebook page. We'll get to those in a moment. Former Mayor, UNF President John Delaney, let's begin with you. Economic uncertainty, worries about terrorism and demographic change, and political gridlock. That's the picture nationally. When we bring it down to here in Jacksonville, a couple of issues stand out. Let's begin with one local issue that's made national headlines, the discussion over whether to expand protections to this city's LGBT community. That has divided this city, and that's reflective of this national political conversation. You've been vocal about this. How do you see this playing into these divisions?
Well, I think even if you didn't have this national angst about Afghanistan, Iraq, Venezuela, the economy, immigration, borders without walls, those kinds of things, I think you'd still have a rift over the HRO, that there's legitimate religious beliefs that would oppose giving equal rights, and I think there's an equity argument that obviously I am persuaded by, that and a fairness argument that we should have anti-discrimination laws that protect the gay community, GLBT community.
Tanya Weathersby, another issue that's jumped out recently, when we look at the national frustrations over demographic changes and fears about terrorism and immigration. Just recently, State Representative Lake Ray filed a bill that would give Florida additional power to screen Syrian refugees. You've written columns about these issues, and as we discuss what's on voters' minds in 2016, you have been vocal as well. How do you see Jacksonville having a voice in this conversation?
Well, Jacksonville is going to have a voice in this conversation because obviously we have agencies here that take in and accept refugees from around the world. And Lutheran Social Services and many other agencies are trying to take in these refugees. But Jacksonville's voice in this really probably isn't any different from a lot of other places. It's very easy when you feel that when a country or any people feel that they're under attack or they're under siege to blame people for it, individuals. They blame the whole group of folks. Back when 9/11 occurred, there was an FBI agent that I interviewed who talked about how Americans are really image-driven people. So it's very easy to see struggling Syrian refugees as people who are behind the problem and can cause problems versus them as being victims. So I would say in that sense, Jacksonville isn't any different from any place else as far as how they want to regulate who comes in, and even though it's wrong-headed. But that's just how it is in a lot of places. But we, probably will have a lot to say about that because we have a number of agencies that do take in refugees and that want to make a place for them here.
Well, and a very large Arabic population in Jacksonville. And I think that picture of that dead baby on the beach just tugged at a lot of people's hearts. And people that have the opposite view probably aren't their voices and being heard right now.
Yeah, I agree.
Matt Corrigan, you're the author of the definitive book on former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, conservative hurricane, as he continues to struggle in the polls. And Donald Trump looks to be still leading in Iowa less than a week out, going to the Iowa caucuses. Let's widen the conversation a little bit and look at Florida. When we get ahead to March and the March 15th primary, Florida voters will have their say. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, they will. And what's interesting about what Trump has done to Governor Bush is he's moved the conversation on immigration so far to the right that really Jeb Bush has been isolated on that issue. Now, there's other problems with the Bush campaign, but that's really, if you think about it, where Trump got his first publicity was his comment about Mexicans and so forth. And so, we were going into this campaign talking about, do you believe in legalization or do you believe in citizenship for illegal immigrants? Now we're at a discussion of building walls and deporting people. And so really, mm-hmm. Bush has been left behind in that discussion. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, in Florida, how is that going to play out in a Republican primary and how will that play out in the general election? In the Republican primary, it probably does okay. We had we have Governor Scott who ran really as a strong anti-immigration candidate in his two elections. But in the general election, I think it's really going to hurt Republicans in the state and will be a real test to see if Republicans can win a general election on the presidential level.
And A.G. Gankarski, you've written about these issues at length for Florida Politics. As we see state representatives like Lake Ray filing bills having to do with Syrian refugees, there is certainly a fine line they're trying to walk in terms of, we're hearing, wanting to endorse a more centrist Republican like Jeb Bush, but at the same time seeing the appeal of a populist candidate like Donald Trump.
Yeah, and Florida is really well-placed for that kind of populism. We have a transient population. A lot of people have moved here recently. You know, they're very much in tune to the kind of rhetorical appeals and red meat that Trump's serving up on the right, and even Bernie Sanders on the left. You know, same kind of thing. Instead of wonkish policy solutions like Jeb Bush is really good at delivering, you know, they're wanting red meat. On the left, they're wanting to hear about greed, 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 as Sanders said last night at the town hall forum. On the right, you know, things like immigration restriction and, you know, closing the borders and all these other things. And really, it's a response on both sides to economic insecurity, you know, specifically related to the white middle class. It reminds me of 1992, in a sense, where he had outsider candidates, Pat Buchanan, Ross Perot, coming in and basically feeding off of the anxiety of the post-NAFTA white middle class. And we're seeing a recursion of that theme.
Tanya Weathersby, I remember Pat Buchanan at the Republican convention saying, let's ride to the sound of the guns. Remember that night?
Barely.
Yeah, but he's recalling that strain. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's I have to pivot a lot off of what AG just said. Most of this is centered around economic anxiety, because when you look at how Donald Trump has been able to play into the whole issue about illegal immigration, which is down, all of those things are down. The facts show that it's not what it used to be. But he's able to play into that mostly because of a lot of economic anxiety. There are a lot of people who believe that people who come in here are taking jobs and all those types of things. And those things are happening when the real issue is that our economy is changing. Technology has made everything more disruptive. People are uncertain about whether or not they're going to have a job. And it's very easy to blame people instead of actually going to the root of the problem. And it's a thing that's always happened. We want simplistic answers to everything.
John Delaney.
Yeah, well, I think there's always been a populist streak in America, and you know, George Wallace tapped into that in 68 and 72. Ross Perot, as Tanya just said, in 92, that was about a fifth of the vote. Yeah. I think Trump has captured this concern about political correctness. Matt and I were swapping some emails about this just yesterday. That how careful you've got to be in what you say, and the country's worried that immigrants can flow across the border. The real problem, frankly, is people that legally come into the country and overstay a visa, not those that pour across a border. Economic uncertainty, as Tanya said. Frustrations with the world stage, where we just don't seem to be the world's policeman anymore to try to solve some of these problems, and the butchery that's going on in Syria and in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And so that's capturing it. I agree with Karl Rove, who says that Trump has a high ceiling but a low floor. I just don't see him being able to get a majority of the votes in the Republican Party. But he sure survived a lot longer than most of us thought.
Matt.
Yeah. What's interesting for, you know, Jacksonville listeners is, you know, the two real big issues that Trump's talking about is, you know, immigration and foreign trade. You know, Jacksonville's been a beneficiary of both migrants and immigrants. It's really helped our economy, and we're a port city, and port is just absolutely vital to our economy. And really what, you know, the economic solutions Trump is pushing are unrealistic, but no one really calls him on it. So that's going to be interesting to follow. What I find interesting the most is really this populism on the left. Because if you look at the big picture, President Obama has been the most liberal president maybe of this century and of the 20th century as well. And so definitely of this century, but of the 20th century as well. And so you would think that you wouldn't have this populist movement on the left, and that his natural successor, who seems to be Secretary Clinton, would, you know, get some benefit from that. But no, there's a real uprising on the left as well. And you're wondering, you know, where that's going to lead.
Sure. Barack Obama's saying Bernie Sanders is just a bright, shiny object, he said just yesterday. Yeah. Let's go to your calls right now. Chris is in Mandarin. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. Chris, give us a call back. Oh, hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Yeah. I kind of missed because I had the delay there. I guess my point I wanted to make earlier was, when we first started off the show, you were talking about the things that were making the voters a little anxious. And for me, it's the polarization, the continuous polarization, as if a Republican and a Democrat don't have the exact same real needs in mind. I'm kind of getting sick of people trying to polarize us, believing that, you know, if you hit one trigger point here, you can get an emotional response that'll be enough to just keep people occupied for a moment while you do things behind their backs. I don't know. it just seems to be an old story that's the story that's not being addressed, is the actual polarization.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, the gridlock, the polarization, Tanya Weathersby, the sense that the two parties cannot work together anymore.
I think that is part of what is frustrating a lot of voters, because they don't feel like anything is getting done in Washington. So you see a lot of apathy, because a lot of people feel like, and to a certain extent, they're right. And I guess that has a lot to do with how the gerrymandering goes and all that, and who actually ends up getting elected to Congress, is that all the people in Congress, all the politicians, just play to their narrow interests, and it causes this gridlock. But it's resulted in a lot of anger from voters, because it seems that nothing ever moves forward in the way that it should. So people just feel stuck, and they don't know what to do. And that is causing anger. I'd agree with the caller.
And John Delaney, as a former office holder or a Republican, that has to frustrate you, I would think.
Yeah, I used to say that we probably agree on 90% of the things, but we spend 90% of our time arguing on the 10 that we don't. Let's get the 90 we agree upon done. And I think Tanya's exactly right. There's this frustration that it's simply not happening. I'm still sort of surprised that the media hasn't paid enough attention to what Bernie Sanders says. I mean, he is a dyed-in-the-wool socialist, and that's really not
Democratic socialist.
Yeah. Democratic socialist, but
as he'll say, yes.
But that's where the American public is not there, and every crazy thing that Donald Trump says gets repeated ad infinitum. And we'll see now that he's sort of making a horse race of it out in Iowa and New Hampshire. Will they go to the substance of what he's saying, as opposed to just calling the horse race the kind of the politics of the thing and the polls? And we'll see where that goes. And I think it's going to add to the polarization. And you sure feel that locally as well.
Anthony in Ortega. Hi, Anthony. Good morning.
Good morning, and hello to your wonderful panel. My concern is American foreign policy. Hans Morgenthau once said that international politics, like all politics, is a struggle for power. And my concern is that America is now perceived in the three superlatives: weak, weaker, and weakest. And I think that has an impact on capital investments and the way that our allies perceive us. And my major concern are is the Iran deal and the fact that the military has been degraded to the point where a lot of our forces are in World War II numbers. So those are my concerns.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Anthony. Those are all concerns that you see the current GOP front runner, Donald Trump, talking about. Matt Corrigan.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Again, if you go back to the Obama administration, it, again, is a clear difference to what really American foreign policy has been over the last 50 years before Obama got into office. In other words, it's been really a retreat from the world stage in a lot of ways, and trying to get our military not to be so heavily involved overseas. The challenge with political science as a science is you can't do these things in the laboratory. You have to go out in the world and try them. And Bush was criticized for doing too much militarily. Obama's tried to really withdraw our military, and both approaches have problems, and these aren't easy solutions. In Syria, I think there's over 4 million refugees. That problem obviously hasn't really been addressed by the United States, but these are difficult problems. And the question is, when we get into this discussion on the Republican side, I can see where all the criticism's coming from, but what are their solutions? And that's what hasn't been really clear yet.
Ricky on the North side. Hi, Ricky. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I got a two-part question. Also, I want to say it's a great pleasure talking with Mr. John Delaney. I've met him a few times, and I think he's a great leader. Okay, my first question is that Mr. Trump is expressing the silent majority, which is very, very pro-Nazi. If he was to ask the Syrian Brotherhood to vote for him, I bet you could get 100%. So my question is, what do you feel about that rift to the extreme right towards Nazism? And the second thing, second part of my question was the HRO issue, in that I think Jacksonville, by not passing that or by not honoring that, is actually going backwards. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, that's Ricky on the North side. John Delaney.
I agree with his second point on the HRO, that we're the last major city to not have a human rights ordinance. But I do understand those with deeply held religious beliefs. I understand some of those concerns, and the ordinance certainly needs to protect those kinds of things. Not so sure about the first part of that. Again, I think Trump is less a Republican than he is a populist, and he hits all those populist kinds of buttons. And you know, there's a trend on that going back to Eugene Debs that sort of tapped into that. Again, I think he's tapped out at a high. I think there's a number he can't get above in terms of the voters. And what's ironic is as with Wallace, as with Ross Perot, and as with Trump, there's a lot of Democratic support for that as well. Matt probably has a better feel for the
Matt
numbers.
Matt Corrigan, the National Review didn't call Trump a fascist, but when they published an editorial the other day urging conservatives to disavow Trump, they said he has strong man overtones. That hints a little tiny bit at fascism.
Yeah, I don't know about fascism, but clearly he sees himself as a strong executive, and I don't think people have really wrapped their arms around that.
And let's bring A.G. Gankarski back into the discussion. A.G.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to consider with Trump, you know, his Democratic support, again, that's, you know, something akin to what we saw with the populist mentioned, George Wallace, Ross Perot, and so on. And, you know, it does come back to the economic dislocation and security. People don't know how they're going to stay in the middle class. Donald Trump is offering solutions, not just any solutions, but the best solutions for the best people, for the best supporters. And, you know, people really want to hear that. But I do want to pivot back to one other thing. A Republican primary is typically you run to the right and then you move to the center in a general election. If Donald Trump were to be the party's nominee, which is a distinct possibility at this point, watch him ameliorate and moderate his rhetoric. You know, gone will be the bomb throwing. It'll be more of the reason Donald Trump, the more likable Donald Trump. He is playing the media and playing the political establishment like a fiddle right now.
I have this sneaking feeling that Donald Trump is trolling the whole country right now with the kinds of things that he's saying. First of all, he is obviously appealing to a populist strain, but the things that he's proposing, he can't really do. I mean, has anybody who's the things that he's saying and he's leading to other Republican candidates to say about building a fence, have any of them been to the Rio Grande area? I don't know. I don't think so.
That's not going to work. Just a few comments on our Facebook page, quite a few already. Joe writes, "We are experiencing a class struggle. It's not rich versus poor, but the government versus the people. The new boss is the same as the old boss." Pete Townsend still has a lot of fans out there. Trump's megalomania matches that of the current occupant of the White House. Eric writes, "There's a lot on the line, especially when it comes to the economy, but I think many feel as if our national identity is at stake, our sense of ourselves." And then Mary writes, "I like Trump because he has shaken the GOP to its roots." Here's one more from Jim. "You know what? It looks as though the GOP is finding out there is no exit strategy from the Southern strategy." Matt Corrigan.
Yeah, the 2 points. And, you know, AG brought up Trump's communication. It's been brilliant. And, you know, as somebody who underestimated Trump early, you know, I just have to really look out on in amazement that he's gone this far basically by using Twitter and free media. Now, he's advertising now, but he's really kind of rewriting some of the books on political consulting. Now, of course, he had a big head start in name ID and all that, but that is something that's going to be important to watch. But this broader point of him being a Nazi or something like that, I don't think I'd go that far. But clearly, there's an undercurrent that's ugly in his campaign. And I think he could have come out, somebody like Jesse Ventura, and said, you know, we need to protect our borders. We need to do a lot of other things, but not go into some of the ugliness that he's gone into. And he's attracted some ugliness to his campaign. And if this is going to be a long campaign drawn out on the Republican side, I think it's really going to be a divisive show.
AG, we are less than a week out from the Iowa caucuses. Donald Trump still looking to be the favorite, although Ted Cruz right behind him.
Watch the Christian conservatives in that caucus, because they always turn out. They always upend the polls. Look at Rick Santorum just 4 years ago. Nobody saw that coming. So you have to ask yourself, where will the Christian evangelical conservatives go? Will they go to Cruz? Will they perhaps go to Rubio? I mean, I'm expecting Cruz to make a stronger showing in Iowa than you know, one might expect. But I would say also that that showing isn't necessarily predictive of what happens in the rest of the country, because the caucus model is not a popular vote model, but it's who wins a particular precinct, and they add those up and they aggregate and they get total. So, you know, look for the Christian conservative turnout, and I wouldn't surprise people.
Let's take one more call as we discuss voter discontent in 2016. It's Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Yes. I heard John Delaney call Bernie Sanders a socialist, and then y'all came back and said Democratic socialist. Do you think Bernie Sanders is hurting himself by not coming up with a new phrase for his philosophy? And could you explain the difference between a socialist and a democratic socialist? Thank you.
Sure. Well, you know, obviously, democratic socialism, as Sanders has talked about on the campaign trail, he'll typically point to the Scandinavian countries as the type of system of governance and the type of economy he'd like to see in this country. John Delaney.
Yeah, well, of course, he's registered as a socialist. He calls himself a democratic socialist, which, is, as you say, is a sort of a European model. And but that's not where mainstream America is. And it is populist, which is where Bernie's coming from the left, to say take money from the rich and give it to the poor. And but there's a certain level of taxation that becomes confiscation. And I just don't think America's going to go that way. As a Republican, I'm hoping he prevails, because I think he's not going to win. And as a Republican, I'm really hoping Trump won't, because I don't think he can win. I've got a theory that the sunnier candidate in the general election is who wins, the one that is more optimistic about the future. And that's where Obama had it over McCain. That's frankly where George Bush had it over what was that, Kerry, I guess, back, or Al Gore, and where what Bill Clinton had over George Bush, et cetera. And the only stick in the mud there would be Nixon over Humphrey. But in a lot of ways, Nixon had a wish for America that was more optimistic than Humphrey, who was sort of saddled with the Vietnam War.
And as you pointed out, Matt, Florida once again will be so important.
Yeah, it'll be important on the primary, because at that point, you're really going to look for a candidate who can win a, you know, a big state after the March 1st series of primaries. So, you know, and obviously it will determine whether Rubio or Bush get to continue on in the Republican primary or not. And then in a general election, it's going to be the ballgame again. It's tough to see the Electoral College Republicans winning without winning Florida.
Tanya Weathersby, let's bring it back to Jacksonville. What are your final thoughts?
My final thoughts are that Jacksonville will probably vote the way it's always voted. I still believe that Jacksonville is a deep purple area. I think a lot of the things that govern how the rest of the country is voting, the economic uncertainty and things like that, will also play into Jacksonville too. But as far as what we're talking about at Bernie Sanders, I think eventually voters will look, you know, closely at what he's promising, the same as Donald Trump. The things that they're promising, it pretty much are undoable. And I think people will come to realize that everywhere. And I think Jacksonville will probably continue to remain a deep purple area, depending on who the nominee is. And I think that it probably won't be who we think it is. And another thing I'd like to say as well, I think that one thing we're not looking at in all this that President Obama used to his advantage was social media. It'll be interesting to see how social media and the use of social media changes or influences the trajectory of this whole election and this whole thing. So.
Fantastic participation from all of you, and we thank you so much for being part of this conversation. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
John Delaney, UNF president and former Jacksonville mayor, with us today. Also in studio, UNF professor Matt Corrigan, author of the Jeb Bush biography, Conservative Hurricane, Florida Times Union columnist Tanya Weathersby, and A.G. Gankarski on the line. He writes for the website Florida Politics. Much more coming up later. Rock legend Graham Nash joins the show, a preview of his special concert tomorrow night out in Ponte Vedra. But up next, it's PBS host Joe Lamp. Find out where you can meet him in town this week. We're back in a moment.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Here's a new phrase for you, water tech economy. Now apply that to Milwaukee, a city known really for its factories.
I don't think it will be Alice Chalmers. I doubt there will be 20,000 jobs based on water, but I think it will be an important addition to the 21st century economy.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How water is making money flow into a manufacturing city. That is next time on Marketplace from APN. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
When it comes to redeveloping downtown Jacksonville, the best laid plans have often turned sour because of spiraling costs or problems with infrastructure. But despite setbacks, the city has made strides in recent years. In Community Thread Downtown Developing, we talk with the movers and shakers who are transforming downtown and meet others who say challenges still remain. Log on to wjct.org/events/community-thread to submit your questions or to RSVP to be part of our studio audience on February 11th.
President Obama has been shining a light on criminal justice reform.
We incarcerate people at a rate that is unequaled around the world. We account for 5% of the world's population, 25% of its inmates.
Now a new report offers recommendations for overhauling the system. We'll also hear from White House Senior Advisor Valerie Jarrett later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Hi, this is Michael Feldman, and thanks to WJCT and the Florida Theater, What Do You Know, Y'all? Is coming to Jacksonville on Saturday, February 20th. We're flying down to check out all 22 miles of beach, maybe do us some fish camping. Join us, won't you? Tickets are available at the Florida Theater box office, by phone at 904-355-2787, or online at floridatheater.com. We'll see you there.
Sponsored in part by Folio Media House.
Welcome back. Well, viewers of WJCT Television's Create channel on Comcast 210 really know him as a familiar face. Joe Lamp, the host of Growing a Greener World, is one of the country's most recognized and trusted personalities in gardening and sustainability. Lamp is in town this week. He'll give the keynote and serve as the on-site sustainability expert for the U.S. Compost Council's annual meeting at the Downtown Hyatt. In fact, it's going on right now. Joe Lamp is on the line with an update and more about all things sustainability. Joe Lamp, a pleasure. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. The pleasure's mine. Thanks for having me.
So exciting to have you on the show. Viewers have seen you not only on our channel and on PBS, but on the Today Show, on the Weather Channel. They've read your books, your newspaper column. It's exciting to have you in Jacksonville. What's happening at this event?
Well, it's an annual conference for the U.S. Compost Council, but it's where all the producers of such a great product get together, and they talk about, you know, the successes and the challenges and how to increase the awareness of what compost can do for gardens and farms and for restoring soil and improving water retention and minimizing runoff. I mean, there's so many things about this amazing natural product that, you know, the challenge is getting the word out there. You know, it's changing the mindset of how people think about solving problems as it relates to what's going on outside their window. And compost has so many solutions for that, and it's just a matter of how we communicate that message to the general public.
And that's something that your show, Growing a Greener World, does such a fabulous job with. You're a national sustainability expert. That's become such a buzzword in recent years, and it's only going to become more important, not just in terms of composting, but in a whole range of ways. Correct?
Yeah, oh, absolutely it is correct. And, you know, it's encouraging because I've been doing this a long time, and it's something I think we were on the cutting edge of years ago when we really started to get the message out there. And it's not just us, but I can say that it's, you know, you feel like you're almost climbing a very steep mountain to get the word out and to increase the awareness. But over the years, you know, more and more people have started using the terms and talking about it in various ways. And so it's becoming woven into the fabric of how we think and how we speak today. But the challenge now is to help people apply what they're hearing to their everyday lives. And for me, in my world of connecting with people on a gardening and an outdoor healthy living lifestyle basis, there's a lot of applications to that. And so that's where I do my focus. But it is really nice to see the slow but steady progress, Melissa, in this area.
And if you could give listeners just one easy tip where they could incorporate one or two sustainable habits into their daily lives, what would it be?
Well, those that get their hands in the dirt from time to time, to me, the solution is not really ever a quick fix. It's really more thinking about how to improve the soil, because the soil really is the basis of everything that comes from it, including all our food, of course. But when we try to do a quick fix and we throw in the super duper man-made fertilizers or the pesticides or whatever to take care of the potential perceived problem, what we don't realize is a lot of that has some residual damage or problems that are being created in the process of trying to fix a certain problem. We're actually making another one. And so if we can focus on improving the soil and let the soil take care of those other problems, which it will do, a good way to do that is truly through composting, which is just, you know, the breakdown of organic matter into what is like soil. But it's incredible. So I call it the superfood of mm-hmm. earth. So
sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's a pleasure to get you on the line for a few minutes. As I mentioned, you are in town at the Downtown Hyatt for one more day, a chance to meet PBS host Joe Lamp. Joe, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
And check out Joe's show, Growing a Greener World, on WJCT's Create Channel 7.2 Comcast 210, Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. Well, he's the Grammy Award-winning rock legend who has spent decades with the beloved supergroup Crosby, Stills, and Nash. But singer-songwriter Graham Nash also has a distinguished solo career, and he's debuting some new material tomorrow night at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. Take a listen. Graham Nash, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And it's so great to have you on the show. Lots of excitement as you prepare to perform at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. And people love seeing you, of course, with Crosby and Stills, but it's also really exciting to see you performing as a solo artist. Now, you're going out on this 2016 tour and supporting this new studio album, This Path Tonight, that's coming out in April. Can you tell us a little bit about this new work?
Yeah, let me see. When we're traveling on the road, you know, we have long since abandoned trying to get, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 people on airlines and stuff. So we travel on a bus. We each have our own individual bus. But we share it with the band members. I share mine with Shane Fontaine, who is the second guitar player in the Crosby, Stills, and Nash band. And after you come off, after a concert and you're going to the next city, you know, sometimes it takes you a while to come down from the rush of performance. So we normally play guitars in the back of the bus. And we wrote 20 songs in a month. And then we recorded, we had Christmas, and then in January we recorded those 20 songs in 8 days. And it was an incredible experience for me. It's a very personal album. It reflects, as most of my music does, what's going on with me as a human being. Mm-hmm. And I think that those feelings are shared by many people.
Yeah,
because I'm just an ordinary person just like you.
20 songs in 8 days, though, that's an incredible creative burst. And
it was an insane experience. I've never quite experienced something like that.
What do you think inspired that? So much work in such a short amount of time.
The changes that I was going through personally, and I had a lot to say about it. And Shane Fontaine was a brilliant partner in providing, helping writing those songs. We wrote the 20 songs, as I said, together. And Shane produced the album, This Path Tonight. And the album really is a journey. The album artwork reflects that. It's a shot of me from the back walking in Woodstock, actually, in a snowstorm. It's a very personal, intimate album, and so far the response to the album has been amazing and very satisfying to me as a composer.
In all my waking days of wonder, all my ways of wrong and right, with all my dreams of clouds and thunder, I wander down this path tonight. All these dangers of destruction fill my breath with life and light. I drink it deep and think about us on this path tonight. This path tonight, where will it lead?
I would think after 5 decades in the music business and being inducted into, you know, the Rock Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, the longevity of your career and to still have that love and that respect from the fans, that's got to be so gratifying.
It's very gratifying. And I think one of the things that the fan recognizes my passion for music, for my passion for creation and my passion for communication between people. I want people not to look at me on stage as you know, this rock guy. I want to look in their eye and know I'm connecting with them. And that happens a great deal more when you're solo. I'm with Shane Fontaine, one of the great guitar players, so it's hardly a solo show, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. It's very gratifying to be able to satisfy people and to give them value for their hard-earned dollar. It's hard to earn money these days. And to think that people want to spend those hard-earned dollars on coming to see me, it's my responsibility to have them leave completely satisfied.
Sure. And in an intimate venue, I think, too, like the Pontevedra Concert Hall, that's a special experience to see you up close that way.
Yeah, it's going to be a nice night. I'm really, really looking forward to performing.
Now, let me ask you, too, as you said, you'll be with Shane Fontaine. That's a really different experience than when people who some of your most devoted fans who may have seen you in the past with David Crosby and Stephen Stills. What's it like for you to go out and tour in this way as opposed to with your bandmates who you spent so many decades with? And sometimes also Neil Young, he comes along once in a while, too.
What happens when you go out solo and simply, which is what I'm doing, you're stripping every single song down to its absolute essence. And in many cases, you know, we're recreating that moment because I'm just playing acoustic guitar and singing just like I wrote the song, right? So it puts the audience closer to the flame, closer to the moment of the creation of the song itself. And when you strip it down to its very essence, you've either got a good song or you don't.
Do you ever run out of ideas? It sounds as though you really don't, that you've just got a bottomless well of songwriting ideas.
You know why? Look at what's going on in the world. I think it's my responsibility as an artist to reflect the times that I exist in. And that's what we've always done as a band. That's what I've always done as an individual, and David and Stephen and Neil and Joni and Jackson and Bonnie, all our friends. You know, mm-hmm. We are incredibly lucky people. And I, for one, am incredibly grateful to be alive and to be creative and to still have a voice.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and so privileged to be with you, Graham Nash. Lots of excitement as you prepare to perform at the Pontevedra Concert Hall at the end of the month. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes.
You're very welcome, Melissa. Thank you.
Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? They're taking me to Marrakesh, all on board.
That is the legendary Graham Nash. He's in concert tomorrow night at the Pontevedra Concert Hall. Just a few seats still available. Get them at pvconcerthall.com. And finally, this hour, she's the founder of a renowned touring company featuring innovative expressions of dance and artistry. Melissa Thodos brings Thodos Dance Chicago to Orange Park's Thrasher Horn Center this week for a residency that includes master classes with local students and a school time matinee. Melissa Thodos joins us in studio along with one of her dancers, Tenley Dorrell. Ladies, good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you so much for having us.
Great to have you on the show. And let's talk about this performance you're bringing. It's the story of Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan, which is a much-loved story. How do you tell that through dance?
Well, dance is our medium, and it's our passion. And the story of Helen Keller is such an incredible one. in our history here in America. And Anne Reinking and I got together and decided that it was an important story to tell through the medium that we love so much, which is dance. It's been done in an amazing movie. It's been done in theater with Gibson's play. And we really felt that dance was a perfect medium to tell the story.
Right. And Anne Reinking, the Tony Award-winning choreographer and dancer, I remember her really well from the Bob Fosse film All That Jazz and, you know, many other performances. She's so talented as well. Now, Tenley, you play Helen Keller in this production. So tell us a little bit about your performance.
Right. I play Helen Keller in this role, and dance is a perfect medium to express her story because the only way that she was able to express herself was through dance or through motion and through her facial expressions. And she's able to portray how she was able to learn how to speak and to read and to understand language.
Right. She was locked inside this world of being unable to communicate. And you use dance as a form of communication in a really innovative way. How did you hit upon this medium? Because you've won international renown for the way you use dance as a form of expression.
Yes, it's such an important form of expression and communication, and it's our goal and our mission at Thodos Dance Chicago to celebrate that in all communities that we reach. That's why touring is so important, and that's also why work in schools is important for us.
That's right, and this residency is so exciting at the Thrasher Horn Center because you're conducting master classes for local dance students. How's that going to be working?
Oh, it's great. We love delving into all the communities where we tour on so many levels. We have a master class scheduled at 5 o'clock tomorrow. We are so excited to be teaching, choreographing, and performing, which is what all of our dancers do at Thodos Dance Chicago.
These are local dance students that this is probably a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for them to work with dancers of your caliber, I would think.
Well, we love working with communities and with intermediate and advanced students. For this particular master class, we invite anyone and everyone who's had some training to come join us, and it is a wonderful opportunity for those students.
How about you, Tenley? Have you been a lifelong dancer?
Yes, since I was three. And I'm
three. Oh, my goodness.
I love sharing dance to young artists or people who are interested in becoming a performer in the future.
Wow. And so what do their faces light up in these classes, I would think? It's just got to be an incredibly rewarding experience.
Definitely. And it's also great for them to see new artists in a new way of thinking about dance from their regular teachers and getting a new perspective on movement and how to express themselves.
Now, in addition to the master classes, there's a matinee for kids. Can you tell us a little bit about that too?
Absolutely. And that is open to the public. And we are performing Our Light in the Dark for students. And what's really wonderful about this opportunity is we have the chance to talk to them afterward with a question and answer session and really dive in more deeply to their impressions of what they saw on stage and their questions about that part of history and who Helen was in our American history.
You have been operating Thodos Dance Chicago for 23 years now. That is an incredible track record, bringing this Chicago style and attitude to the world, really. And is this your first time here in Northeast Florida?
It's our first time here in Orange Park. We have performed in Hollywood and also in Sanibel. And we're always thrilled to come to this wonderful warm weather being in Chicago right now.
I was
in January.
Just going to say, did the blizzard hit Chicago as badly as it hit everywhere else or no?
No, actually it didn't. We were worried about our flight time here. But last year, this time of year, we were actually in the blizzard out east in Vermont. So we're really thrilled to be here.
I absolutely right. And it's Thodos Dance Chicago, A Light in the Dark, the story of Helen Keller and Anne Sullivan. It's Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. at the Thrasher Horn Center for the Arts. But as Melissa mentioned, there will be master classes and a matinee as well. So go to thcenter.org to learn more and get tickets, especially if you have a young dancer in your house, which I'm sure a lot of listeners do. Such a pleasure to meet both of you. And enjoy our somewhat warmer weather. It's kind of cool for this time of year down here, but for you, I'm sure it feels really warm. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
She's Melissa Thodos and dancer Tenley Dorrell joining us. Again, it's Thodos Dance Chicago's A Light in the Dark, the story of Helen Keller and Anne Sullivan. That's Thursday night at the Thrasher Horn Center for the Arts in Orange Park. That's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers this morning. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And you can now watch the show. It's streaming video on demand at tvjax.com. Check it out online. Next on Diane Rehm, cases of the Zika virus have been reported in at least 21 countries in the Caribbean and in North and South America. The mosquito-borne virus is suspected of causing brain damage in babies and paralysis in adults. A closer look at efforts to control the spread of the virus and prospects for a vaccine. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.